Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Emily Wanless is an associate professor of political science at Augustana University. She chaired the initiated and referendum task force. Legislation drafted or recommended by that task force, I should say, is under consideration this session in Peer, and she's with me now in the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Emily, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Nice to see you in person instead of on the phone.
Yeah. It's easy across the street.
Yeah. So let's start with we followed this process with you. You were generous enough to come on pretty much, I think we made every meeting to talk about the progress and the process and seeking listener input. And now those recommendations are going to peer. 10 different recommendations. What's the overall landscape look like for this in peer right now?
Yep. So after four meetings this past summer, we were able to come up with 10 pieces of legislation that we thought almost for the most part unanimously as a task force, which I think is a testament to the strength of the proposals as well as the intent of the task force, that we had bipartisan support on a majority of these proposals. So we came up with 10. Some are pretty non-controversial and are just looking to maybe clarify or are more process oriented, in terms of working with the LRC and some of the limitations that they operate under, size, staffing, stuff like that. And then there are some pretty significant changes that were proposed, most notably the raising the voter threshold for constitutional amendments. So we have 10, and they've all been addressed at some stage already in the legislature. So
all moving forward at some point at this point, or some have already been left behind?
Some have already been left behind. Yep. So we have out of the 10, we have 4 that have passed one of the chambers already. Mm-hmm. We have 5 that have passed the committee. They're both in the either state or house the House or the Senate State Affairs Committee. Okay. All of them are. 5 have passed the committee level, and 1 is essentially dead. We had suggested after quite a bit of time of back and forth amongst a working group of the task force and then the task force at large, a citizen review commission. Mm. And we struggled with it as a group, and the committee the House State Affairs Committee struggled with it as well. I think everybody was behind the spirit of it, which was to increase voter education. I don't know that logistically we were all on the same page, and I don't know that in the end what we suggested really did anything substantively to merit the amount of time and energy and cost.
Sure.
And so I think that was recognized by the legislators dealing with it.
What part of the process was that review panel supposed to engage in?
Sure. So, well, it probably depends on who you ask, which is, again, maybe part of the problem. But, I came at it as this is a way for a nonpartisan or at least bipartisan group to come together with no particular agenda for or against these ballot measures, to hold hearings, increase awareness, increase an understanding of what these would actually do, and then produce something that voters could feel confident in, in knowing that it was, true, or as true as it could be. And that wasn't what ended up coming out of it. What ended up coming out of it was a hearing that would produce a summary that no one was compelled to go to, and then that would be published on the Secretary of State's website for any voter to go and seek out if they so choose, not mailed, which was another possible iteration of this commission. So
sure.
It became just another way to get information out, but it would be information that people would probably already have.
Right. But it was innovative.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's, when you look at the big picture, there's an innovative solution for something that addresses part of the problem, and it just didn't make it all the way through, and that's okay. But
And I think that one thing, so one, it was modeled off of another state. There are a few states that do this, and so it is possible. And one thing that I did like out of it was that we came up with a solution of, well, this costs too much. Well, the solution is let's utilize the technology that we have. The Secretary of State's website already has a ton of information about these initiative and referendum proposals. And so let's add another piece and let's find a way to get people to start going to these websites to get this information. And so I would like to see that move forward in any sort of future iterations, the utilization of technology.
We talked earlier on this program today with the Speaker of the House, Mark Mickelson, and he was saying that, you know, one of the, you know, themes, if you will, of the first few weeks of the session is there's a lot of legislation talking about the ballot process. Mm-hmm. Do you, and I didn't clarify with him if he was referring to these 10 bills or if there were other lawmakers bringing their own solutions. Do you have an awareness if this is really, is everyone behind, in peer behind looking at these 10 bills and saying, well, this is what we're going to, not saying we're going to pass them all, but we're going to examine them all, or are there other lawmakers bringing, you know, outside the game?
Well, there's the solutions. The campaign finance task force that met, and they've put forth a number of proposals as well that deal potentially with ballot issues. And then there are other legislators off the top of my head. I think an example would be Senator Nesaba, who was also a part of our task force, who was also you know, pretty involved with the payday lending ballot measures last election cycle. He's proposed to increase transparency and disclosure on financial aspects to these ballot measure committees. Mm-hmm. So there is some independent work going on. There is the other task force, and then there's the 10 bills that we're coming up with, which, you know, is on their mind because they are working on them currently. I mean, they're actually being taken up.
All right. So let's talk about one of these significant ones, or, you know, high profile ones, which is raising the voter threshold for changing a constitutional amendment. Give me the basics of what that looks like.
So Senator Bolin brought forth this to our task force, and he will be very open and honest about it. That was one of the reasons he wanted to be on the task force. He very much wanted to address the misuse of the constitutional amendment process, in his opinion, that because of an inability of the legislature to amend or repeal a constitutional amendment versus an initiated measure, which becomes a statute, which the legislature is then able to amend or repeal, some folks are using the constitutional amendment route versus the initiated measure route, which means we have bills that are becoming amendments that probably aren't suited to go into our Constitution.
And so expand on that, though.
Yeah.
What's help us, because I think what's happening is the voters are expressing their frustration and saying, let's go this way because then lawmakers can't tinker with it. But help us understand what should go in the Constitution and what should go as an initiated measure. How do you explain that to people?
That's a tough question because it's pretty subjective. But I think that you want something that's long lasting, something that is broad enough that can withstand the test of time. I mean, you look at comparatively in Alabama, for example, they have a very liberal use of what is a constitutional amendment, and they've amended their constitution hundreds of times. And it gets to be a problem when it curtails what the legislature can and cannot do. And most often it's unintentional repercussion of a constitutional amendment being kind of too narrow in focus. So typically you want something a little bit more broad, a little bit more flexible that can withstand the test of time, that, you know, doesn't need to be changed based on maybe economic circumstances, things like that.
Okay.
But what was occurring, at least in these more recent cycles, is the belief that the constitutional amendment has been misused. And so Senator Boland's point of view is that if you raise the threshold and make it harder for for a constitutional amendment to pass, people will be less likely to go that route.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's already harder to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot than it is an initiated measure. So there's incentive already to go the initiated measure route. Where I think that South Dakota has run into a problem is that people don't trust that the legislature will listen to what they say at the ballot box. And so as a result, they'd rather go the harder route, but know that once the decision has been made, it would be preserved. Something I proposed, and this was something that did not make it out of the task force, but I think that the increasing the voter threshold for a constitutional amendment has some merit to it, but I don't think it gets at the problem. It doesn't solve the problem. It only solves half the problem. So you needed to incentivize people to use the initiated measure route and disincentivize the use of the constitutional amendment. Well, we're disincentivizing the constitutional amendment, but we're not incentivizing them to go the initiated measure route.
And that incentive would be can't tinker with it.
A waiting period or a supermajority in order to amend it, both of which are done in other states. It's something that, you know, what I proposed was kind of like the craziest of crazy versions of this. And so it didn't really gain enough traction to be worthy of discussing and tinkering, but I do think that is something that would help if the true desire is to preserve the Constitution. I think you got to come at it from both sides.
So, big picture question: how much of this conversation that you hear, just in the coffee shop or on the streets or in your classroom, with the folks that reached out to you during the task force meeting, how much of this conversation is being driven by people who believe that with a super majority in the state house of Republicans, that there's a specific area of, more liberal or more progressive or however they would define it, legislation that they can't get through, and therefore they need to get it through in this way, and they'll try to figure out however, and skepticism about peer. How much of it is really just being driven by that, and how much of it is being driven by sort of the, statutory or constitutional details that are being tested and stretched? Does that make sense as a question?
It does.
Okay.
I think that it is a mixture of what you'll see is a mixture of those things. One is that there is a group of people who feel like they have no voice in the legislature, and so that their only route is the initiative process. And they were vocal over the summer. They came at our task force with a heavy dose of skepticism. What are you doing? Every single thing. And today, if I am hearing from people, they are concerned that it wasn't at all our intent or our motive by what we suggested, but they could see it going one way. And so that must have been our motive. So there's a lot of skepticism. For example, one of the things that we put forth is that the Board of Elections should have control over the size of the font and format of these ballot measures. First of all, it's our understanding that they already have control. So this was really just a clarification.
Sure.
But the response was, that means that they're trying to be able to limit the substance because eventually it'll morph into will limit the amount of words you can use. Mm. Not at all the intent. The intent was the Secretary of State's office told us that the accordion style petition is much easier for them to process than one that has to be folded 10 different ways.
Right.
And so we were like, okay, well then the State Board of Elections can just require that it be in an accordion style. But it morphed into, they're going
to
limit.
What are you up to?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's that skepticism. A large group, from what I could tell, is also are people who really respect the tradition and process of people being able to participate in this form of direct democracy. It's something that started in South Dakota, where it's a part of our history that we're very proud of. And so it really much needs to be preserved.
Yeah.
So there's that part. And then I think there is a part of those that work in lawmaking or are involved in the legislative process that realize that there are certain issues that legislators just aren't going to touch for whatever reason.
Sure.
Whether it be politically motivated, whether it be personally motivated, there are issues that they're just not going to raise in the legislature, whether it be ethics, accountability, whether it be more controversial social issues.
Sure.
And so those historically and in present day across the country are issues that seem to make their way on the ballot only because of initiated measures.
All right. So here, this is another broad question about this process in South Dakota, because I'm sure you've thought a lot about it. But what about these notions of calling your, you know, representative, calling your state senator, you know, making sure they know exactly who you are, talking to your friends, running for office yourself, mm-hmm. getting the vote out for an opponent if you don't like the person that's going to appear? Are we losing that, or is that happening too? Do we tend to lean too heavily on, you know, signing a petition and passing something, or not? Is it all happening at once, and this is part of the big soupy mix that is South Dakota politics?
No, I think that, I mean, I think that if you look historically, I mean, if you go way back at the beginning of our history with the use of initiated measures, it was actually used more than it is today.
Okay.
Then it kind of like plateaus out, and that's not really the route that, that citizens are choosing to participate in. But I do think that as we continue to see kind of this partisan divide, that is both grassroots and national. I think that there is a national tone that has trickled down into South Dakota that just kind of leads to people being hyperaware. And whether, you know, my students would love to say that it's always, their default answer is, oh, this is change in technology. Like we have access now, we have ways to reach out to people. And so participating is easier now. Signing a petition is pretty easy. You know, during that heightened season, you go on any street corner and someone's going to approach you. And so it's a way for people to participate, I think, that's low stake.
Right.
I think that trouble happens when voters go to the ballot box and there's a long list and they're not necessarily, you know, educated enough or feel comfortable enough, so they don't vote, you know. So that there is room for us to improve in South Dakota if we want to have this process and we want to continue to allow people to participate this way. I think it's our responsibility to do everything we can to increase the access and information available for people. I mean, one of the comments was, oh, if we do these mailers, I mean, how many of them get thrown away? And it's like, well, does it matter? I mean, it does matter. And there are things we can do other than just throw paper at people. But I think it should be a priority.
And it's interesting you say that, because I remember last, you know, election cycle when we had so many ballot questions, and I just knew them by the time we were done, you know, forward, back, I could explain essentially both sides, who was arguing for what. And I would, you know, meet family members or friends, and they would have no, I had never heard any of it, had not paid attention at all, and were still surprised at the, and that was the moment where I just sort of realized, you know, we care so deeply about this, but we have to always remember that there are some people who, you know, are busy and have things to do, and then they go in to vote. They want to vote. They want to be part of the process, and they're just hit with this, like, what happened sort of moment, because they weren't as keyed into it.
Yeah, so
as we were.
I would say two things really quickly about that. One is, you know, we have a representative democracy for a reason. People don't want to make a choice all the time on everything. And so some people just prefer to make one choice and then have people make good choices for them. And if they don't, then we can vote them out of office. The second thing I would say is that people who are tuning into your show, people who are aware of what these ballot issues are, well, I would consider them the political class, right? And that they are not necessarily representative of the average voter.
Right.
And so we have to keep in mind, you know, I get feedback quite often from people saying, you know, you have no trust and faith in our voters. I do have trust and faith in our voters. Otherwise, I wouldn't want this direct democracy process of initiative and referendums. But I also am realistic, and I know that there are a large subset of the voting population that is not as aware and educated as they could be.
Right. And how do you give them that information in a way that makes sense for them when they want it, how they want it,
right,
so that they can make up their own minds that's fair and accurate and useful?
Yeah, I think, well,
it might be a piece of paper.
Honestly, the Secretary of State's website. Yeah. So I do some work on state politics, and I utilize state secretary websites a lot. Mm-hmm. And say what you will about a lot of aspects of our state government and being, you know, small South Dakota, our Secretary of State's website is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's got a ton of information, historical and current. It's user friendly. And so it could be as simple as just getting people to go to that website, whether, you know, you pass out not even a piece of paper, but a little card and say, right, you know, here's how you can get more information on this. Mm-hmm. And it's all out there. It's just a matter of how do you get it to people when they want it, like right, you said.
Yeah. We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute with more from Emily Wanless. Stay in the moment on Listener Supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. We're talking with political scientist Emily Wanless. She's associate professor of political science at Augustana University. Full disclosure, where I graduated from, Augie there. So she chaired the Initiated and Referendum Task Force. And we're talking about legislation that's now in peer, working its way through committees that would impact how the, you know, ballot initiatives and constitutional amendments end up on your ballot during the fall election. And we talked about the significance of raising the voter threshold for constitutional amendments, which how high, if that passes, would that threshold be?
The one that came out of our task force was 55%.
Okay.
There was chatter, I don't know if it'll end up happening, but chatter that it could be proposed by another legislator at 60%. Mm. But I think Senator Bullen, who is sponsoring this, felt that had the greatest chance of passage at 55. It was more palatable at 55. And just to give you some information, I gathered some data on the past use of constitutional amendments. So from 1970 to 2016, we had 45 constitutional amendments pass at that 50% threshold. If it had been 55, 31 of the 45 would have passed. And if you raised it to 60, only 14 of the 45 would pass.
Okay.
So there is an impact that could arise from raising it from 50 to 55.
Marcy's amendment
would have passed.
It would have passed,
yep,
anyway.
Yep.
So, and Speaker Mickelson talked about efforts to sort of adapt that now. So that's not chiseled in stone either. How do you undo a constitutional amendment?
You have to pass another constitutional amendment.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Right. Or, you know, if there's vagueness to the amendment, you could tackle some of that vagueness with statute. But
okay,
it's harder for them.
What else is on this list?
So we have, I talked about that Board of Elections, the size and mm-hmm. font one. That has passed the House and it's in the Senate right now. One that is currently being worked on, and probably the one I'm the most frustrated that it just kind of slipped past us, which is this idea of simplifying the recitation statement, the yes and no. Mm. So when you go to vote, here I am saying that we need to increase voter awareness and education.
Right.
So one thing that we do is make these simple declarative sentences. If you vote yes, this is what happens. If you vote no, this is what happens. It was not simple and it was not clear as it currently is. And so it was suggested by our task force that we change it so that a yes means basically accept or take action, and a no means maintain the status quo. Mm. That's how it worked for initiated measures and constitutional amendments. But for referred laws, mm-hmm. It basically, by having that statement, yes, you know, take action, was really saying no, don't take action, mm-hmm. and no meant yes. So in order for you to approve the law that was being referred, a voter would have to vote no.
Right.
And so I've been in conversation with members of the task force, members who serve in the state legislature and the LRC, and they are working on clarifying that language.
Sure.
It's been deferred on the House floor for a couple of days. My understanding is they're trying to meet to change the language to make it a little bit more consistent and clear. The intent was there.
Right.
Again, we talk about skepticism. I've heard some grumblings that, oh, we were trying to hoodwink the voters. Mm-hmm. And really, if you think about what a referred law is, it's the law, the legislature is taking action, and generally it only becomes a referred law on the ballot if somebody's not happy with it, somebody being the people. Mm-hmm. And so a yes would mean strike down the law that we're presuming the people were unhappy with.
Right.
But it isn't clear. So they're working on that, which I'm glad, because
has it been like that?
We passed it that way. Yeah. So, right, and in our head it made sense, mm-hmm. but then when you just take it as the two statements, you're like, backwards.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that will get fixed.
And that goes back again to those people who are prepared and have thought about it. I mean, I remember marking it before I even went to the ballot box to say, I am going to vote, this on this one because this is how I feel. And, but if you're taken aback by it and you're surprised and you're trying to read through that information now, then it can get very overwhelming.
Certainly. And the goal is to make it easier. Right. So why are we making it more complicated?
The goal is to make it so that you are expressing your real wishes.
Right.
At the ballot box, and the easiest way to do that is to communicate, the easiest communication so that you know what you're voting for.
Well, yeah, and studies have shown that when people don't know what to vote for, they'll vote no. Mm. And so you have to be very clear and consistent with what you mean by no.
Right.
And so that was one thing that we were attempting to do, that I think once they figure out this referred law language, it will do that.
What else is ahead?
So we've got that. 15 working days for the LRC to provide substantive comment on when people submit a petition for review. So prior to circulation, prior to going to the Attorney General's office, the LRC is overworked, overburdened, small, understaffed. And so they asked for more time after testimony. We agreed to give them more time. There's some concern that there's a pause period in there during the legislative session that people feel that causes an undue delay. Mm. I say when the deadlines and the pause periods are. And so you can accommodate those in your timeline, especially since... one of the other proposals that we have is that you can submit your proposal to the LRC up to 30 months in advance of the process. So you can have all of your ducks in a row and have a full 12 months to circulate your petition rather than eat into your 12-month timeline by waiting to get commentary from the LRC, which is a requirement. We could not push back the submission timeline. That was not a suggestion we could make, because after listening to the Secretary of State, they can't process the petitions fast enough in conjunction with monitoring elections.
Right.
And so moving the date in which you have to turn in your signatures wasn't feasible. And so we kind of came at it from the other direction. Now, there are those that are complaining that there was no timeline of 30 months beforehand, and that presumably if this law doesn't pass, people could submit 36 months in advance. What we've heard from the LRC is that a promise that they would always review any petition that came to them prior to that 30-month start date, but they would not be bound by the 15 days turnaround.
Okay.
So it's, again, I can see why people, if they're looking for a reason that this task force is seeking out to change and curb the use of the initiative and make it harder. But I just don't think that that's the spirit, the intent, or the reality of what would happen from these.
And those things matter.
Yeah, I think so.
Spirit, intent, and reality.
Yep. I listen, and if we could hash it out, and that's what they're doing, So if if people feel strongly that they don't like the ambiguity or the potential for something to happen, contact their legislator and let them know.
Now, now is the time.
Now is the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We're not done. Yeah. We are short of time, though, on our end. So, Emily, we could have you here for the full hour, and we'll probably have you back as these things move through peer. And if you have comments or questions that you want us to address on this program, you can always email me in the moment at sdpb.org. For now, we'll say thank you to Emily, and we'll see you next time.
Great. Thank you, Lori.